back together again, you and I chatting it up. Brand new week, Monday, August 28th, 2023, on Connecticut Today. We welcome back local gasoline and oil industry analyst Mike Vox to chat about the prices at the pump. CT News junkie and Substack blogger Terry Cowgill returned from his vacation for his weekly update. And I also had a few opening thoughts on repeat criminals. Mike Vox now joins us from the Gasoline and Auto Service Dealers of America. We haven't had Mike on in a while to talk oil and gasoline. Mike, it's Paul here. Good afternoon. How are you?
Hey, Paul. Nice to see you again.
Good to hear your voice there, Mike. Well, let's take a look at what you see and hear heading into the Memorial Day weekend. Gasoline prices, Mike, what do you have for us, short-term, long-term? What are your thoughts?
Well, we've been seeing a big uptick in retail prices over the last 5 to 6 weeks. The upside seems to be fighting going higher, but all indications are that prices will continue to go higher. We have actually two problems. One we can do something about today, one we can't. The issue we can't do anything about is the federal policies that are currently coming out of Washington with banning drilling on federal lands. Courts just undid that. Of course, courts cases take forever because of appeals. So the current policies out of Washington, D.C. don't favor lower retail gasoline prices. What we can do, though, is call our local representatives and our local governor. We have two state gas taxes on gasoline, one being the state gas tax, which is 25 cents a gallon, and the other being the gross receipts tax, commonly referred to as the GRT. The GRT tax was put in 2012 to help replace leaky underground storage tanks, and that program ended. So we're paying a tax on a program that doesn't even exist, and it was canceled back in the Malloy administration. Governor Malloy canceled that program. Now, we were told that the state was in such a budget deficit, couldn't eliminate that tax, had to keep it. Well, $6 million in budget surpluses over the last two fiscal years. Now we have an additional $350 million surplus. It is time to end the gross receipts tax. That would lower the retail price of gasoline in Connecticut the day it's done, approximately 21 cents a gallon. That's a hefty price tag for consumers to be paying for a program that does not exist.
By the way, I mentioned the holiday. I meant to say Labor Day for all the folks out there going, you don't know what it is. No, not Memorial Day, Paul. Labor Day. Mike Vox continues with us. Mike, how much and to what extent is the ongoing fighting in Ukraine between Russian and Ukraine forces affecting the price of gasoline?
Well, okay, so we have to be careful of not falling for what I call political and media excuses, and I don't mean you on the media side. Mm-hmm. You've always been very good. Ukraine is a problem because of the current policies out of Washington. If we had the old policies, and you know me, Paul, I'm not pro-Republican, I'm not pro-Democrat. Mm-hmm. I call it right down the middle. If Republicans do something wrong, I say it. If Democrats do something wrong, I say it. These current policies that we have in Washington have taken away our energy independence. We would be energy independent, wouldn't matter what happens in Ukraine, wouldn't matter what happens with OPEC, wouldn't matter what happens in any other part of the world, we would maintain lower prices. You remember the days when I was up in Hartford advocating for a policy called fair wholesale pricing, and I testified on the record under oath that the retail price of gasoline in Connecticut should be about $2 or lower. Everybody mm-hmm. laughed at me and said it could never happen. Well, we saw that when President Trump was in office and he put in the proper policies in Washington. We saw prices in the state of Connecticut below $2 a gallon. And oh, by the way, below $2 a gallon with the gross receipts tax. So if we get good policy out of Washington and we eliminate the gross receipts tax, you can imagine where that retail price of gas would go. And today, with inflation, that's big money in everybody's pocket.
Mike Vox, what about the notion of the changeover now from the summer blend to the winter blend? Are we in that yet? Are we approaching that? How long does that take? What are the particulars on that again?
So because we are in a non-attainment for ozone ratings, which is air quality, we have to have a special blend of gasoline in the winter. Now, again, if this special blend of gasoline is so good that it results in clean air in the winter, wouldn't common sense tell you that it would be even cleaner air in the summer when the temperatures are higher and it burns off? So again, why isn't the policy out of Washington, instead of doing this summer and winter blend, why don't we mandate this all year round in all 50 states, and it's mass produced and it'll be even cheaper? These are the policies, and then we get stuck in, is this a Republican Party policy? Is it a Democrat policy? How about policies that put money back in the taxpayer's pocket, not policies that enrich one party or the other? I am so tired of these political arguments. It's incredible. Let's just put in policy that works for America, works for American taxpayers in all 50 states. Some of them are national. Those particular policies that I was speaking about are national. Our governor here and our legislature really can't do anything about that. We can come next November by putting someone different in the White House who has those type of policies. Now, here in Connecticut, the only thing that we can do to immediately put 21 cents back in our pocket is get rid of the gross receipts tax. And I'm hearing rumblings of a special session, so let's do it then. We saw the result when the current governor suspended the state gas tax at 25 cents. Yeah. 25 cents came off the retail price immediately. This is 21. So I don't understand why we can't do it. The federal government gave Connecticut COVID money in the billions. We had a budget surplus of $3 billion, then another budget surplus, and now the budget surplus is about $350 million. I know what they're going to say. In the out years, we're broke. Fix it in the out years. Stop spending money on a program that doesn't even exist. We don't even know where the money goes.
And Mike, finally, are you hearing anything from your member dealers, your member stations regarding this notion now? And there's a little bit of backpedaling on it, saying, hey, starting in 2027, we're going to start phasing out the sale of new internal combustion engine vehicles in the state, and we want to be the ICE vehicle-free situation by 2035. Anybody you know on the record or off the record reacting to that?
100% on the record. Yeah. I testified both in the morning and the afternoon public hearing.
Oh, good.
I have sent in over 25 pages of documents out of Washington, D.C., from the EPA and from the Department of Energy, publicly stating in those reports, and I had to go through 5,000 pages to find the answer, that electric vehicles are not the answer. Two reasons. Number one, Bloomberg just did a big study about all the abandoned electrical vehicles and those batteries leaking and causing pollution in the ground. Bloomberg did a phenomenal job. They have pictures of thousands of electric vehicles abandoned in China. All of the minerals that we need, we don't have them here in the United States. We don't even have a plant that's making the batteries for the cars here in the United States. Why do we want to become dependent on China when all appearances are China is U.S. enemy number one? It's like the masks during COVID. We couldn't get the masks because the only place they were producing them was China, and China was keeping them for themselves. So electric vehicles have a place. They're just not what we're being told they are. That once we buy in, here's the fact, Paul, and I'm glad you have me on the air.
All right.
The United States, the entire United States, only contributes 14% of the pollution, the emissions in the air that we need to get rid of for climate change. China contributes 41%. If every single vehicle in America today, if we could wave a magic wand and every car was electric, it would only improve, according to the Department of Energy, not Mike Fox, because I represent gasoline stations, 0.18. So we would go from 14% polluting the air to 13.8. It just doesn't make any sense to make, again, taxpayers spend $60,000 on a car,
yeah,
and then service stations are going to close. And you know where those service stations are going to close? In the areas we need them most, in the low income and the rural areas, because their gas volumes are already down. So it's the exact opposite of what we need to be doing. What we need to be doing is keep pushing innovation, higher standards for clean tailpipe emissions. We need to be looking at hydrogen or compressed natural gas for cars. Why? Infrastructure's there. We could sell compressed natural gas through the typical service station on the corner. And you could still sell gasoline. Those are the ways to go, because the only thing that comes out of the tailpipe with compressed natural gas and hydrogen-powered vehicles is water.
Water, yeah. Yeah, interesting.
So, and the car manufacturers, it's a lot easier to do it. What our politicians don't understand is that there's an old saying, follow the money.
Oh, yeah.
We have to find out who's getting paid to produce these batteries, or just like Biden gave $2 billion to the bus company, and they went out of business. They filed bankruptcy already. So now schools have been mandated to buy electric buses, and the only company that produces them just filed for bankruptcy. Smart politics are politicians, right?
There you go. Mike, don't hold back. Mike Fox, our buddy, our pal, Gazda, GASDA.org. Mike, thank you. Keep an eye on the numbers for us and call me back whenever, okay?
Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. All right. And I found that story that Mike is mentioning there. Yep, here it is. China's abandoned obsolete electric cars are piling up in cities. Look at this. You can't. It's on the radio, but good Lord. He's back with us after some well-deserved time off. Looked like he was having a good time where he was. Terry Cowgill, who blogs at the Connecticut News Junkie, ctnewsjunkie.com, and also authors the pithily named column Red Meat for Mushy Moderates at substack.com. Terry, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon to you, Paul. I am refreshed and ready to go. As they say, fired up and ready to go.
Fired up in the starter's blocks and you're all set. I know one thing you wanted to chat about today, Terry, which is one thing that I really harped on about a year and a half, 2 years ago. We were getting into this. The whole adult recreational marijuana market all around the country and here in Connecticut. This, Terry, is not, although, listen, I think we did the right thing. This is not the panacea business-wise everybody thought it was going to be.
No, there are problems with it. Certainly here in Connecticut, the market is still growing, but you know, it hasn't even been legal for that long in Connecticut. So we're still in sort of our market is still sort of in its infancy. Mm-hmm. But if you look around at some of the states where it's been legal for some time, there are definitely problems. And, one of the problems is that the markets are not really like you and I would think they would be, say, for another product, mm-hmm. Like, oh, I don't know, tires or, you know, furniture. Because, you know, and currently right now they have there is an excess of cannabis in certain states out west. Mm-hmm. And when there's excess, they can't take the excess marijuana and ship it to another state that's experiencing a shortage because interstate shipping of cannabis is illegal under federal law because cannabis is still a Schedule I narcotic right along there with heroin and, you know, ecstasy and all these truly dangerous drugs. So you have that. You have some states have taxed it excessively. They've made the barrier to entry very difficult so that, you know, if you want to get before the Cannabis Control Commission in Massachusetts, you have to hire a bunch of lawyers. And I assume you do here with the cannabis regulatory agency here in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of problems associated with that. But essentially what we have is we have too much product and too many cannabis outlets in many of these states, including Massachusetts, where the Boston Globe thundered with a headline about 2 weeks ago, pot prices have tanked. Dispensaries are closing.
I saw that.
A great crash coming.
Yeah.
Did you see that?
Yes, yeah. I did. And Terry, the other thing that I've been watching, particularly in Massachusetts and in California as well, is the whole, like, where is the sweet spot on taxation? Because everybody's saying, well, we're going to tax this by the ounce and this by the flower. And, Terry, you have a lot of guys and gals who I would think, and I guess they said this was the problem in California, where, you know, by principle, they want their marijuana, they want their stuff, a lot of users, but they don't want to pay all these extra taxes. So, you know, they have a friend or a relative who can go in and buy in bulk, as we say, And then you have these people saying, hey, here's $5. Can I have a joint? In other words, there are people by principle, Terry, who are like, yeah, I could use it once or twice a week, but no way am I paying these taxes. And I read where that's another kind of questionable thing, too. Where's the sweet spot here?
Yeah, and I don't think they've found it yet. You know, I mean, the sweet spot typically is just enough taxes or high enough taxes that the state and the municipalities get plenty of revenue, mm-hmm. but it doesn't drive voters or consumers to the black market. And that's what's happening in California, for example.
Yeah.
They have taxed it to the extent that lots of people are just saying to hell with it and they're just going with the black market. And that kind of defeats the whole point of legalizing it. So, yeah, they do have to find this a sweet spot. They have to find a regulatory sweet spot, too. But you just – I know certainly in Massachusetts, I mean, you just have – I think they said that there are retail marijuana prices in the state have plummeted by more than half all over the last 2 years. Now, that's a huge cut in prices, and it's going to make everything much more – much less profitable. And also, since it's a federal banned substance, mm-hmm. You can't deduct your business losses the way you can in with a regular business. So they've got that to deal with. It's just all kinds of problems.
Yeah, Terry Cowgill is the guest. And then, Terry, you have finally on the marijuana thing, you've got the scenario where I think as of this past July 1, you can essentially, as old guys like you and I used to hear in college, you can grow your own. So what's the impetus for anyone? Now, it's not an easy thing to grow. You know, I had friends in school who were amateur horticulturists doing this, but they did it. So, I mean, Terry, what's the – you buy your grow lights and everything's legal now as long as you have it in your home. So that's going to affect things as well.
Yeah, it is. It's but you're talking about finding the sweet spot, right? It's also legal to make wine, a certain amount of wine in your own home, and brew a certain amount of beer in your own home.
Mm-hmm.
But how many people really do that, and how does it actually affect the commercial markets? I don't actually know the answer to that question, but I suspect it has a wine and home beer making have a minimal effect on the markets. Maybe it's different for pot.
It's a good thought. Terry, finally, I know you wanted to talk about the and I think we can do this now. I think, assuming that Vivek Ramaswamy has actually stopped talking, but I think we can talk about last week's GOP debate. I'm sorry, but geez, what did you think?
You know, I had this discussion with my friend up in Maine, whose house I was at for my vacation, and he's a diehard Republican, really is. He's been a Republican for as long as I can remember, and I've known it since high school.
Yeah.
And I told him, I think Republicans love, or at least the Trump people, love Vivek Ramaswamy.
Oh yeah.
For the same reason that Democrats like Pete Buttigieg.
Yeah.
They're awed by his verbal ability. but verbal abilities do not necessarily make for strong leaders.
Yeah,
you have to have a lot of other qualities as well. But Ramaswamy was up there on that stage, and he stroked every erogenous zone of the Trump voters there, and you could just hear him every time he spoke. They hooted and howled. You know, it was just like there was a tingle rolling up their legs. I've never seen anything like it.
Oh boy.
Man.
Who did you like, though? Because I still think in the end, Terry, I still think DeSantis is going to be the nominee. But who impressed you?
Well, I thought Nikki Haley showed me something. And frankly, I hadn't seen anything from her earlier. She came out with what was really sort of a general election message rather than a primary message, which some people might say is premature. But she basically took Ramaswamy to task for saying that, he thinks that Russia should just get part of Ukraine and then be done with it. You know, what's the big deal if China takes Taiwan? And she basically dressed him up and down for his foreign policy naivete. She came out with what I thought were valid points about abortion. And that, yeah, it may make us feel good to think, you know, we can enact a 20-week or a 5-week ban federally. But you need 60 votes to do that. You can't do that. We need to compromise, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. I thought she showed me something. I thought Pence was good. Christie was, you know, Pence is a, he was a former radio host. Like,
oh, yes.
Like you.
Yes.
And,
so.
Now,
Terry, I've already informed my audience I have no desire to seek federal office. So just so you know that.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Especially not vice president, which isn't worth a warm bucket of spit as a person once said. I thought Christie, you know, he had a reputation as a fierce debater, but except for that one line he got off, telling Ramaswamy that he sounded like he was ChatGPT, you know, Christie didn't really show me that much. So it was fun to watch, and I told my two friends who I was on vacation with, I said, I have to watch this tonight because I know I'm going to have to write about it or talk about it. So I did, and it was good sport, but get rid of the audiences. I mean, really, this is just, it's horrible.
Yeah, and Terry, finally, I'm interested. So your staunch Republican old buddy from way back, what are his thoughts? Is he pro-Trump, anti-Trump? Is he sticking with him? Does he want somebody new? I'm just trying to get the feel of this.
Yeah, he doesn't like Trump personally. He thinks Trump is kind of a rube, and you know he's very unsophisticated and really. But he liked his policies.
Yeah.
So he held his nose and voted for him. He kind of liked Ramaswamy too. He said, "Well, you know, I mean, he's young. I don't know if he could get the job done." But there were other people, and he's my friend in Maine has a place in South Carolina. In fact, he owns a business in Charleston.
Ah.
And he said, Tim Scott showed me nothing last night. Tim Scott was flat, and all he has is a biography and nothing else. So I thought it was interesting because of the fact that, you know, both Haley and Scott are from South Carolina, and so is my buddy.
Interesting. All right. Check him out, folks. Yep. Terry Cowgill, CTNewsJunkie.com, and on Substack, Red Meat for Mushy Moderates. Terry, take care. We'll talk to you next week, sir. Thank you.
All right. Look forward to it. Bye.
All right. Thanks, Terry. Bye-bye. All right. There you go. So a long time ago in a land far away, in a galaxy far away, pre-social media, I know it doesn't, that seems so long ago, but it wasn't really all that long ago, where if you really wanted to know what the ne'er-do-wells, the great unwashed, those who would wreak harm upon us, if you wanted to know what they were doing, you had to literally sometimes, unless you had a good local newspaper or maybe your larger metro paper did a good job at this, you had to literally go to your local police station and take a look at, remember they used to call it, I guess they still do technically, it's called the police blotter. And the police blotter was usually a chart or a log, like a book-like log, where the public, by law, could look at arrest records. Now, some of the records didn't quite have the, you know, the detail that people wanted, but by law, arrests and what a town-supported, city-supported, taxpayer-supported police department was doing was public record. And the newspapers used to do that, the local papers, the advertisers. Remember the local papers back in the days when the big papers dominated, you had little local advertisers, you know, to fill space. They would say, okay, so-and-so town police blotter, June 1st to June 7th. You know, June 1st, 10:05 p.m., minor misdemeanor arrest for loitering, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, we all know of the police blotter. Now, that really, and I guess it still exists in some way, shape, or form regarding that. But apparently now, most police departments do this online, particularly on Facebook. It's tough to do it on Twitter. It's tough to do it on Instagram. So Facebook is what I use and what you should use, and make sure you like your local police departments. The reason I'm starting with this is that it is now a great way, and I hazard to say an easy way and a necessary way that you should use to keep, you know, up to date with what your local police departments are doing. And by that, you also keep up to date with the lunacy, the sheer idiocy, the things that happen that get people upset that our lawmakers are supposed to, I don't know, do something to fix, and year in and year out, they don't, because there's arguments of, well, we need fewer people in jail, and we need to give people more chances, and it's the law-abiding gun owners that are the problem, not the criminals. Why am I saying this? Well, I saw something a few days ago that was brought to my attention, and it was a Facebook post, a social media post by the North Haven Police Department, North Haven PD. And now I'll read now, and you may be familiar with the area, you may be not, but the purpose of it is to illustrate again why people are angry and why we should pay attention to this and why you should vote accordingly, even if I know, my God, you're a Democrat, it might mean voting for a Republican who might be tougher on crime. And I know everything in your head right now, rent-free, is Trump, but there are other things going on. The country will be fine. Trump will eventually go away. But how about we pay attention to stuff that affects you and me the most? North Haven Police Department saying in January of this year, a Fitch Street resident reported a burglary to his 2014 Chevy Corvette that was parked in the driveway. Okay, so here's a guy who parks his car, guy or gal, says he is here. Guy parks his car in his driveway. Kind of a nice car, 2014 Corvette. So you're talking about a 10-year-old Corvette. The suspect forced entry into the locked vehicle. Okay, so the vehicle is locked. So, you know, the person who locked the vehicle apparently thought it would be okay and maybe took the chance that there wouldn't be, you know, some alleged criminal coming by and trying to get into it. Now, the suspect here forced his way into the locked vehicle and stole. Now, here's a mistake. Who keeps a gun in their car and locks it? Now, that's mistake number one. I don't mean to victim blame here, but that's dumb. The suspect here stole a Ruger handgun along with other items. So that's a no. That's a not good on the car owner here. I know there's a crime involved. I get it. But come on. Who leaves a gun in a locked car? I know, maybe technically you could do it, not smart. Detectives processed the vehicle for evidence and with the assistance from the Connecticut Forensic Lab, identified the suspect. All right, now this gets better here as we start with an item from the police blotter. On August 22nd, 2023, which was... let's see. So that would be on last Tuesday, probably during the show, maybe as we talked last Tuesday. 28-year-old Sammy Medina from Waterbury was arrested. By the way, you notice here all these city gangs and crooks that go to the suburbs. You know, I've been told this by the Wallingford cops. A lot of this stuff you see in Wallingford is not necessarily also in North Haven, Hamden. These are the New Haven ne'er-do-wells, the Hartford, the Waterbury, Meriden, Middletown. You get the scenario here. A lot of them come in from out of town. 28-year-old Sammy Medina from Waterbury was arrested. Now, here you go. This is the good part here. This is the stuff you have to pay attention to. Never mind that your state rep or your state senate member, you know, got the local elementary school money for a new playscape. All right. Or never mind that your state senator or state rep shows up at your son's rubber chicken Little League dinner or your daughter's rubber chicken softball dinner. That's not the issue here. Medina was charged with burglary in the third degree, theft of a firearm, and criminal possession of a firearm by, here we go, you ready for this? Okay, three words here, and I know this is going to be tough. And criminal possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. Did you hear that? He was charged with burglary in the third degree, theft of a firearm, and criminal possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. Huh, I'm shocked. This wasn't a law-abiding gun owner, but let's pass more gun laws. Yeah, you Democrats in Hartford, Governor Lamont, it's always the gun. It's never the piece of filth that has the gun. criminal possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. Shocking. Aren't you? I spent the last couple of days, I had to seek counseling. I couldn't sleep at night. I was nauseous. I was heaving. I was throwing up, having lower intestinal distress. I couldn't deal with the fact that a convicted felon is facing another gun charge in Connecticut. Really? I'm just shocked. I'm shocked. Here's the best part. Medina, now this says currently, this is 6 days ago, but at the time this was posted, Medina is currently being held, or was at the time, on a, ready for this, a $21,000 court-set bond, which I think means the most he would have to put up is $2,100. So you put up in some way, shape, or form, I think 10% of the bond. Now, they actually lower the fine folk in the General Assembly. They actually lowered that to 7%, but that might not, shockingly, apply to a gun crime. $21,000 court-set bond. Now, he was set to be arraigned last Wednesday. I don't know what happened. I can go online and look for the disposition of that. If he's still being held, I don't know. Now, with all due respect here, the guy, the gal, whomever, who put this car in his or her driveway with a locked handgun inside, not smart. But be that as it may, you should be able to keep whatever you want to in your vehicle. But the bottom line is here, we hear this over and over and over again. A convicted felon with a gun charge. A convicted felon with a gun charge. And good job, North Haven PD, by catching this, I'm sorry, alleged perpetrator. Do I have to be nice? How do we fix this? Does this take smarter voters? Are the voters just getting what they vote for? Well, Paul, you know, it's so tough to change the sentencing guidelines in the state and to amend the Constitution to give the judges in the state more leeway. Well, then why in the hell don't we do it? Why don't we do? I don't understand. Why don't we do this? And this guy, now he's a convicted felon. He's facing a charge. Who knows if this gets nollied or whether it gets pled down. But what about hitting guys and gals like this? I'm just suggesting something here. Maybe I'm out of line. I don't know. But what about hitting guys and gals like this? And maybe they do. I don't know. With, you know, on this conviction of an offense for, you know, possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, should they get out of jail within the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years? Oh, you can't put people away for that long. Why not? Because to me, when you're a convicted felon and you're committing burglary and gun crimes again, why should you have the ability to be on the streets? I'm sorry, I'm not trying to sound like some hang 'em high judge here. But this is ridiculous over and over and over again. How about this one from North Haven? Police arrested 21-year-old Quadell Vickers from Ansonia for burglaries to two commercial businesses, which occurred on March 27th and May 20th. Vickers is part of a burglary crew that's been utilizing stolen motor vehicles to commit burglaries all across the state. After securing a stolen motor vehicle, the burglary crew would target businesses and steal cash registers, safes, ATMs, and other merchandise. Detectives working in collaboration with surrounding towns completed a thorough investigation of these crimes, which is still ongoing. Vickers, who is currently incarcerated, what a shock. Another career dirtbag. Was charged with burglary third and criminal mischief third for the March 3rd incident, burglary third, conspiracy, blah, 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 blah for the May incident. He's being held on a court-set bond of $100,000 for his two crimes. Oh, my God, he may actually have to put up $20,000. What do we do with these career criminals? I mean, honestly, 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. I'm telling you, we need to build. We have all those rolling hills and the land in the northwest corner of the state, the northeast corner of the state. We have nice big plots of land. We need to build more prisons and get these people off of the streets. Stop with the babying. Stop with the multiple offenders here, 2, 3, 4, 5 times. Stop setting sweetheart bail levels for somebody who's a convicted felon with a gun. Are we serious about this or not?